Hear now the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
And what do I have for you today for values of you, which includes Claudio M., who is in calm right now. So I'm going to do the same thing that I did on Tuesday, and I'm going to read you some things out of Analog, formerly Astounding, science fiction magazine. And this is from the July 1961 number, which has a couple of really unusual qualities about it. The first is that the cover illustration has nothing to do with any story or indeed any of the contents, really. The title is Heavy Industry 1995, and it shows an asteroid and a large mirror apparently focusing sunlight onto the asteroid, a spot of which is glowing white hot, and then a spacecraft of some kind with the legend Astro Steel Corp painted on it. Anyway, stories include Randall Garrett and Clifford Simak. Let's see. A Spaceship Named McGuire by Randall Garrett. Conclusion of The Fisherman by Clifford Simak. But that's not what I'm going to read to you from. You see, the other unusual thing about this is the glossy paper section in the middle. You very, very rarely ever see that in one of these magazines. But it's got high-quality photographs printed in it. Of course, I can't read you the photographs, but they're to illustrate the science piece entitled Hell's Own Problem by Harry B. Porter. So the very first thing in the article, before the text starts up, is a picture of some kind of rocket taking off. And the caption is, an experimental ballistic missile is test-fired. Flame temperatures of future propellants will be 2 to 3 times as high as those used in present-day rockets, or about the temperature of the surface of the sun. Temperatures must be increased to raise the efficiency of rocket motors. Official United States Navy photograph. Did I mention this is the July 1961 number of Analog? Anyway, this is a long piece, and I don't think I'm going to get through all of it. But, again, this is one of those very interesting science fact articles by somebody, you know, involved in doing the work. One of the stories that used to make Grandpa chuckle in his beard was about a professor who was describing, with great enthusiasm, his development of a universal solvent. When I perfect it, said the professor, this marvelous substance will dissolve anything, literally anything. That'll sure be wonderful, remarked a tobacco-chewing listener. But what are you going to keep it in? Whereupon the professor retired to a small town in Missouri, where he devoted the rest of his life to developing a hardy strain of purple petunias. This old wheeze seems very unfunny to modern rocket engineers. Why? Because the old prof's spiritual descendants are now busily engaged in developing new, super-powerful, super-high-energy, super-hot rocket propellants. Before the beginning of the missile era, a temperature of 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit was considered high. The blast furnace, with a temperature of around 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit, was a symbol of just about the ultimate in high temperatures, second only to the place which, regarding a woman scorned, hell hath no fury like a. Now, that is a convoluted sentence. Second only to the place which, regarding woman scorned, hath no fury like a. The development of rocketry since the Second World War, however, has introduced new concepts in high temperature. Gases from a blast furnace could be used to cool the nozzles of modern rockets. Propellants currently in use burn with flame temperatures in the neighborhood of 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Propellants that will produce temperatures up to 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit are now available, and much higher temperatures are in the offing. In passing, it may be pointed out that the temperature at the surface of the sun is about 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit. For hot components of rockets, such as combustion chambers, nozzles, and jet vanes, the best materials we now have will hold up for only a few minutes of propellant burning time. The highest melting points known, those of hafnium carbide, tantalum carbide, and certain carbide alloys, are in the vicinity of 7,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Only a few other substances have melting points that come anywhere near that figure. Even if a high melting point were the only requirement to be met by a calorimetric material, which it is not, it is apparent that the time will soon come when the rocket researcher will be in the same predicament as the professor with his universal solvent. Footnote, calorimetric, a material possessing sufficient resistance to extreme high temperatures and severe erosive conditions, etc., to permit its use in the operating environment of a rocket propulsion system. See, What in Blazes is High Temperature? Missiles and Rockets, February 15, 1960. And then here is another illustration. USS Norfolk launches an ASROC anti-submarine rocket. The huge billow of smoke obscuring the Norfolk amidships is evidence of the incredible volume of gas that roars through the nozzle throat each second. It might seem that, inasmuch as high temperatures cause so much trouble, the logical thing to do would be to develop cooler rather than hotter propellants. This is where the second law of thermodynamics rears its ugly head. A rocket motor is a heat engine, just as much as is a steam engine, a turbojet, or the motor in your car. That means that it converts heat into mechanical work. The heat released by the burning of the propellant is put to work accelerating the combustion gases through the rocket nozzle. This acceleration of the gases, which results in the thrust that propels the rocket, is accompanied by a drop in gas temperature. Conversely, there must be a drop in temperature to convert the heat energy in the combustion gases into the mechanical work of pushing. In other words, a rocket motor, like any other heat engine, must have available a temperature difference in order to operate. If any degree of efficiency is to be attained, the difference must be considerable. Although a rocket motor is far from being an ideal heat engine, its efficiency and power output can be raised by increasing the operating temperature range. The temperature of the escaping exhaust gases cannot be lowered to a point below that of the environment in which the rocket is operating. The temperature of the atmosphere varies somewhat with altitude, but compared with combustion chamber temperature, the variation is so small that, for practical purposes, the atmospheric temperature may be considered constant. The same goes for the temperature of space. Since we can't very well lower the temperature of the atmosphere, the only way we can increase the operating temperature range is to raise the temperature of the gases in the combustion chamber. To do this, we must use propellants that burn with higher flame temperatures. And there's a photograph captioned oxyhydrogen torch test of a potential calorimetric material. Results are indicative of the material's ability to withstand high temperature and erosion. I'll remark here that there is a somewhat more sophisticated explanation, which also helps to get at the fact that lower molecular weight exhaust gases are preferred. But I'm not going to try to go into it here. It really calls for some place that you can draw the equations on a chalkboard. From the foregoing, it should be pretty obvious that any substantial increase in rocket efficiency will be contingent to a great extent upon the development of much better refractory materials than those we have. There are four general requirements that must be met by calorobic materials. 1. Resistance to high temperature. 2. Resistance to erosion. 3. Resistance to mechanical shock. 4. Light weight. Not all of these requirements must be met in every application. For example, a component subjected to high temperature, without being exposed to high-velocity gases, would not have to be erosion-resistant. Nor would light weight be a must for a very small component or a thin coating. The ability to withstand mechanical shock is always desirable, but might not be critical in a shock-mounted component. Resistance to high temperature is a necessity in all cases by definition. As will be noted in the following discussion, the four basic requirements are, to some extent, interrelated. For this reason, it is hoped that a certain amount of repetition will be excused. The properties that influence general ability to withstand high temperature are melting point, or temperature at which softening or disintegration takes place, resistance to thermal stress, thermal expansion, thermal conductivity, tensile strength, and chemical reactivity. The ideal calorobic material would have a melting point well above the flame temperature or the temperature of the gases to which it is exposed. This is especially true where the material must withstand structural stresses because, with few exceptions, known materials lose most of their strength long before they reach the melting point. Graphite, which doesn't actually melt, is one of those exceptions. Resistance to thermal stress is one of the most important requirements. Many materials have adequate strength at elevated temperatures, but fail miserably when subjected to rapid and extreme changes in temperature. For example, every housewife knows better than to plunge a hot glass tumbler into cold water, or vice versa, although the glass may be heated or cooled slowly without cracking. The direct cause of thermal stress is the unequal expansion, which occurs as the result of unequal temperatures in a solid body. The body may be a large rocket nozzle, or it may be a coating only a few thousandths of an inch thick. If the coefficient of thermal expansion is low, differences in the expansion of adjacent regions within the body are slight, and thermal stresses are correspondingly small. High thermal conductivity, by allowing heat to flow rapidly through the body, produces a relatively uniform temperature distribution, thermal equilibrium, and therefore uniform expansion in a short time. Tensile strength is, of course, necessary to withstand whatever thermal stresses may be produced. Elasticity also adds in resisting thermal stress because the more elastic the material is, the more deformation it can stand without breaking. And there's a photograph on the facing page, which is hard to understand visually, but it says, experimental nose cone being tested to evaluate its high temperature resistance and insulating properties. Electrically produced radiant heat closely simulates aerodynamic heating. As the material decomposes, heavy vapor is released upper left, carrying away some of the heat. Thermocouples inside the nose cone measure rate of temperature rise. And unlike the others, which are captioned official U.S. Navy photo, this is infrared photo by the author. As I say, the most interesting of these articles sometimes are the ones written by somebody who is waist deep in a problem. There's another very good one about liquid hydrogen technology that I'll read some of for you. From the above, it is obvious that in general, thermal stress resistance varies directly with thermal conductivity and tensile strength at high temperature, and inversely with thermal expansion and modulus of elasticity. The higher the modulus of elasticity, the less elastic is the material. Thermal expansion, in addition to the important role it plays in resistance to thermal stress, is an important design consideration. The difference between the thermal expansion of the refractory and the supporting material must always be allowed for, especially where direct bonding is involved, as in coatings. As mentioned previously, high thermal conductivity is an important factor in thermal shock resistance. Its effect on the overall resistance to high temperature, however, is not definitely known. The advantage of high resistance to thermal stress is in some instances partially offset by the melting or softening of one or more of the constituents of a composition having high thermal conductivity. Also, where the refractory is to function as a heat retarder or insulator, high thermal conductivity is certainly not an advantage. Then a photo, official United States Navy photo again. Nose cone after heating in the radiant heat chamber. A reflector concentrates heat at the tip to give the same heat distribution over the surface that results from high velocity through the atmosphere. Now, I don't know if that's a Polaris reentry body or what, but it certainly looks to me like the ones used for the Corona satellites, the film return capsules from the first photographic reconnaissance satellites. High tensile strength at elevated temperature is very important in rocket nozzles and other hot components that are subject to structural loads. Its part in thermal stress resistance has already been discussed. In general, the tensile strength decreases as the temperature goes up. There are a few exceptions, however. The tensile strength of graphite increases, within limits, as the temperature increases, and the strength of certain cermets increase markedly, by a factor of 3 or so, when they are heated from room temperature to about 1800 degrees Fahrenheit. What is a cermet? He'll define it later. Chemical reactivity is a matter of great importance in the selection of refractories for most rockets. Some refractories, otherwise suitable, oxidize rapidly at high temperatures. If such materials are used, they must usually be protected by oxidation-resistant refractory coatings. Molybdenum and graphite are examples. Most metal oxides are immune to further oxidation for obvious reasons. And there's another official U.S. Navy photograph. Static firing test of a Polaris booster motor. Materials are exposed directly to the exhaust blast during tests such as this to determine their resistance to the rocket operating environment. In the past, oxidation resistance was not considered important in nozzles and combustion chamber liners unless the combustion gases were known to contain oxygen or oxidizer left over after the propellant was burned. And many engines, of course, run rich in the oxygen-absorbing component, the kerosene or hydrogen or what have you. At extremely high temperatures, however, the combustion products are dissociated, torn apart to form ions or free radicals. Such fragments are exceedingly active chemically, and compounds such as carbon dioxide, heretofore considered strictly neutral, may become efficient oxidizers. For this reason, practically all rocket exhaust gases are now suspect. Refractories for some applications in liquid propellant rockets must be able to withstand attack by hot fuming nitric acid. The nitric acid is used as an oxidizer to burn the hydrazine or other fuel. Some of the so-called exotic rocket fuels employ chemical reactions that do not involve oxygen. For example, reactions between fluorine and various light metals release enormous amounts of energy. In the future, such fuels will doubtless be commonplace, and non-reactivity with fluorine and possibly a number of other corrosive chemicals will be a requirement to be met by rocket refractories. A friend of mine had a father who was involved in evaluating fluorine-based rocket propellants. I've never heard anything good about them from anyone who worked with them. The ideal Matter of fact, apparently at Bell Aerospace, back in the late 50s, early 60s, when they were working on a fluorine hydrazine engine, the official safety briefing was, you know, if contact with skin occurs, make him comfortable and call a priest. The ideal refractory material should have good structural properties. In general, however, known refractories have low tensile strength, especially at high temperatures. They are brittle and have poor resistance to mechanical shock. Their low strength-weight ratios make them particularly unsuitable for structural use in missiles, where every ounce of weight is important. At present, two major classes of refractories are known. One, pure metals and metal alloys. Two, ceramics. There would be practical advantages in the use of metals as rocket refractories. Most metals are ductile and possess a high degree of fabricability, which is a $4 word engineers use to impress each other. In other words, you can make things out of them without much trouble. It was evident from the first, however, that metals, even the so-called superalloys, would not solve the rocket refractory problem. The best of them, with few exceptions, soften or melt far below the temperature of the combustion gases that they would have to confine and direct. Those few metals and alloys that do not melt at present operating temperatures have densities so high as to make them undesirable for use except in small amounts. For example, tungsten, rhenium, tantalum, and osmium melt at 6100, 5700, 5400, and 4900 degrees Fahrenheit, respectively. Their respective densities are 19.3, 20.5, 16.5, and 22.5 grams per cubic centimeter. High temperatures are exceedingly difficult to measure accurately, and every investigator comes up with a slightly different set of values. For that reason, the melting points above, as well as those following, are given to the nearest 100 degrees. This rounding-off procedure is a safety device employed by the author to keep him from sticking his neck out too far. Despite their serious shortcomings, some of the more refractory metals are used in hot components. Molybdenum, for instance, is often used in nozzles at a terrific weight penalty, and tungsten is frequently employed as an erosion-resistant coating. Metals are also being used in compositions with ceramic materials. Right, here I'll note that niobium, known in those days more often as columbium, has been used for nozzles because of good temperature-resisting properties and somewhat lighter weight than molybdenum. Then there's another photo. Static firing of a pack-rat missile. Rocket motors are sometimes tested in the vertical position to measure thrust and misalignment, one cause of which can be unequal or asymmetric erosion of the nozzle or nozzles. I'm not sure what I'm looking at. It looks as though it might be a solid fuel system with vectorable nozzles, but I'm not certain. That I don't think I've ever encountered a pack-rat missile before. Ceramics are the oldest of the refractories and were among the first, if not the first, artificial materials developed by man. Their long history as liners for fireplaces, ovens, furnaces, and kilns naturally suggested their use in rockets. Originally, the term ceramics applied to baked clay products such as pottery, tile, etc. Through general usage, however, it has come to include all inorganic non-metallic products whose manufacture requires the employment of high temperature. Raw materials for ceramic products now include intermetallic and normal metal compounds, as well as graphite and the so-called hard metals. Although ceramics, as a class, have higher melting points than metals, they are inherently brittle and therefore have low tensile strength. Metallic oxides, foremost among the orthodox ceramic materials, are still looked upon by some workers in the field as true ceramics. Their high melting points and non-susceptibility to oxidation have attracted much attention. Despite their brittleness and poor thermal shock resistance, they are regarded by many as the ceramics most likely, in combination with refractory material, in combination with refractory metals, to eventually result in materials that will meet the stringent requirements of rocket service. The name hard metals has been conferred upon a group of rather unorthodox inorganic compounds which, in addition to the hardness and high melting point that are characteristic of ceramics, possess physical properties, thermal and electrical conductivities, metallic luster, etc., that are usually associated with metals. The name is misleading because the hard metals are metal compounds, not metals. Chemically, for instance, silicon carbide is no more a metal than silicon dioxide. I don't think I've ever come across this term in modern usage. Carbides, borides, nitrides, and silicides of the transition metals of the 4th, 5th, and 6th groups of the periodic table are included among the hard metals. Of these, the carbides and borides are the most important as rocket refractories. The transition metals, by the way, are elements that do not seem to have completely learned how to be well-behaved metals. Sometimes they act as if they have negative valences instead of the positive valences that self-respecting metals are supposed to have, sort of a chemical transvestitism. On occasion, they combine with other metals of their ilk, or with metalloids such as boron and silicon. High temperatures are required for the creation of these compounds, but once formed, they are among the most thermochemically stable materials known. Each of the hard metals exhibits its own set of properties, which cannot always be predicted on the basis of the known properties of its constituents. It is possible, however, to generalize to some extent. Carbides, as a class, are distinguished for their hardness and high melting points. In general, they have higher thermal conductivity than the oxides. With few exceptions, carbides are superior to oxides in high-temperature tensile strength and in resistance to thermal shock. Their main weakness is their susceptibility to oxidation at high temperatures. And then there's a photograph. A nozzle, after firing in a test motor, shows almost no erosion. The material will be tested further. The borides are among the more promising materials for rocket refractories. As a class, they are extremely hard and have very high melting points. Borides of zirconium, tantalum, titanium, niobium, and tungsten all have melting or decomposition points above 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit. The highest of the group is 5,500 Fahrenheit for zirconium boride, and the lowest is that of tungsten boride at 5,200 Fahrenheit. Borides are considerably more resistant to oxidation at high temperatures than the carbides, and their resistance to thermal shock is somewhat better. Their main disadvantage is brittleness. Another photograph on this page. Nozzle, originally having the same throat diameter as the nozzle shown on page 95, after a firing test. Failure of the material to withstand erosion will eliminate it from further testing. And yes, this has got a very messy off-center hole in it. Clearly, it hasn't stood up nearly well. Graphite is almost unique among refractory materials in several respects. The most recent measurements of its sublimation temperature give values around 6,500 degrees Fahrenheit. Its density, 2.26 grams per cubic centimeter, is lower than that of any other known refractory. It has a high thermal conductivity. It is almost completely immune to thermal shock, and its strength increases within limits as its temperature rises. It is easy to machine and widely available. Graphite would come very close to being an ideal nozzle material were it not for two serious weaknesses. One, its susceptibility to oxidation, and two, its softness, which gives it poor resistance to erosion. Nozzles and jet vanes of graphite have been used with various degrees of success where the combustion gases are not especially oxidizing. If the gases are highly oxidizing, however, graphite must be protected by an oxidation-resistant coating, in which case the refractoriness of the composite part is limited to that of the coating material. A considerable amount of research is currently being done on graphite. There have been three noteworthy advances recently. pyrolytic graphite, a high-density graphite, and solid solutions of graphite with the carbides of several refractory metals. I will remark, of course, that the oxidation resistance of graphitic materials has been substantially improved over the years, as witness the leading-edge materials on the space shuttle, which, of course, were graphitic and were exposed to air plasma, which is very oxidizing. Not very dense, though, which helped. But it was that was the one part of the thermal protection system that wasn't repeatedly replaced. By combining refractory substances with each other and with metals in various ways, the desirable properties such as general thermal resistance, mechanical strength, and ease of fabrication may be greatly improved. Some compositions exhibit properties that are more desirable than might be expected from the properties of the materials they contain. There are two general classes of composition: bonded ceramics and cermets. In bonded ceramics, it is usually necessary to use a binder for one or more of the following reasons: to give the plasticity and cohesiveness necessary for working the mixture into the desired shape, to impart one or more physical properties not possessed by the pure ceramic, to cement the grains of ceramic material together in the finished product. If used for workability only, the binder may be a fugitive material, that is, a material that will burn out or leave the scene of action in some other manner before the final firing. Fugitive binders are usually organic materials such as pitch or a synthetic resin. Cold forming by slip casting, extruding, or cold pressing usually requires a binder to hold the molded shape together during subsequent sintering or firing. Hot pressing, on the other hand, does not ordinarily require a binder per se, since the shape produced by that method is as strong when it leaves the mold as it will ever be. A binder, though its primary function may be to impart desirable physical properties, is usually less refractory than the ceramic with which it is used. This, unfortunately, makes it necessary to sacrifice some refractoriness in the composition and to gain such property in order to gain such properties as ductility and tensile strength. Bonded ceramics are of three types: glass bonded, metal bonded, and self bonded. Conventional ceramic products, enamels, porcelains, etc., are glass-bonded. This means that, during firing, partial fusion of some of the material results in the glassy phase, which acts as a binder. At high temperatures, the glassy phase becomes liquid. Obviously, the formation of a low-viscosity liquid phase is highly undesirable in a rocket refractory, so we can forget about glass-bonded ceramics. And then there's another U.S. Navy photograph here, which sort of gives away the key to the whole thing. Cutaway of a regeneratively cooled nozzle and ignition chamber. Liquid fuel enters between inner and outer shells through the fixture at the aft end, then spirals forward to the combustion chamber. Whilst flowing inside the double wall, the fuel picks up heat, which it returns to the combustion chamber. Thus, the heat is not lost from the system. At the beginning of the modern era of research on refractories, carbides bonded with metals or metal alloys, for instance, titanium carbide and chromium nickel cobalt alloy, had for many years been successfully used in high-speed cutting tools. The use of such materials, called cemented hard metals, apparently suggested metal-bonded ceramics, which now include almost all possible combinations of ceramic materials and refractory metals. The two classes of material are distinguished by the relative proportions of metal and ceramic. Metal predominates in cemented hard metals, and metal-bonded ceramics are predominantly ceramic. Physical properties of metal-bonded ceramics are generally a compromise between those of metals and those of ceramics. They exhibit a higher strength-to-weight ratio, far less brittleness, and much better thermal shock resistance than conventional ceramics. Ductility, thermal conductivity, and resistance to mechanical and thermal shock can be increased by increasing the proportion of metal, but this results in a lower melting point and a higher density. The strengths of metal-bonded ceramic bodies are in some instances higher than those of either the metal or the ceramic component. For example, at 1800 degrees Fahrenheit, cobalt has a tensile strength of about 2,500 pounds per square inch, and titanium carbide, 17,000 pounds per square inch. At the same temperature, the tensile strength of a body composed of 80% titanium carbide, I'm sorry, that's not tungsten, it's titanium carbide, and 20% cobalt, is 34,600 pounds per square inch. To bond a ceramic to a metal, it is necessary for the ceramic to be wet by the molten metal. The metal must flow smoothly over and adhere intimately to the surface of the ceramic. It must not draw away and form globules, as mercury does when it is poured on a sheet of glass. Some ceramics can be wet more readily than others. Titanium carbide, for example, can be wet by a variety of metals, which accounts for its popularity as a component of metal-bonded ceramic compositions. To avoid the limitations imposed on refractoriness by metallic binders, the self-bonded ceramics, including ceramic substances bonded by other ceramics, were developed. This type of material fulfills expectations by retaining the high melting point of the ceramic constituents, but does not possess the toughness nor the ductility of the metal-bonded type. It exhibits the characteristic brittleness of ceramics. Solid self-bonded shapes have been made of a number of ceramic materials, including carbides of titanium, zirconium, tungsten, tantalum, vanadium, and silicon. Silicon carbide has also been bonded with silicon nitride, graphite, molybdenum disilicide, and zirconium boride. For more than half a century since it was discovered that iron carbide existed in cast iron and steel, it has been known that very small amounts of nonmetals or metal compounds in solid solution with a metal can profoundly affect the physical properties of the metal. So it is hardly surprising that somebody got the idea that combinations of ceramics and metals, either chemically bonded or in solid solution, might have a higher degree of refractoriness than metals and greater strength, ductility, and resistance to thermal shock than ceramics. Materials of this type are called cermets, a name coined from ceramic and metal. Cermets, like ordinary metal-bonded ceramics, have higher refractoriness than metals and higher tensile strength, ductility, and thermal shock resistance than ceramics. They are very hard, and therefore resist mechanical erosion quite well. For this reason, they have been used as liners and protective coatings for rocket nozzles. A few years ago, there was a great deal of enthusiasm about the future of cermets. There were some who believed that they were, or soon would be, the complete solution to the refractory problem. Unfortunately, such has not been the case. Cermets have about the same properties as metal-bonded ceramics and are much more expensive. There is another class of materials that should be mentioned here, although they are not usually thought of as being refractory. I refer to certain plastics, mainly the phenolics. In case you're wondering, that is bakelite, the stuff that the handles on your hands are probably made of. In combination with refractory ceramic fibers or powders, they have performed quite satisfactorily as linings for combustion chambers, as ablative insulation for nose cones, and as heat shields and nozzles. As a rule, they are not very resistant to erosion, but some of them are able to resist high temperatures much better than one would expect. Their high temperature resistance can be attributed to several factors. They have low thermal conductivity, which limits the high temperatures to the immediate vicinity of the exposed surface. They decompose at high temperatures, giving off gases which carry away some of the heat, thereby lowering the rate of temperature rise. And in decomposing, free carbon is formed and converted to graphite by the high temperature. Graphite, as has been mentioned previously, is a very heat-resistant material. There is evidence that if the plastic contains a metal, such as zirconium, tungsten, or hafnium as a filler, some of the carbon resulting from the decomposition of the plastic forms a carbide with the metal at high temperatures. This also improves the heat resistance. The foregoing is only a brief review of currently available refractories. Whole volumes could be, and in most cases have been, written about each of the materials mentioned, and many not mentioned. So it is obvious that any more than a very general treatment is beyond the scope of this article. Although the number of basic refractories is limited, the number of possible combinations in various proportions is infinite. Enough work has been done, however, to make it possible to establish certain areas that are promising and others that are not. Few of the rocket refractories now in use were developed especially for missiles. Most of them were developed for use in other fields and have been adopted by missile engineers until better materials come along. This does not mean that no research and development is in progress. Quite the contrary. Almost every week, someone announces the development of a revolutionary new material that has taken all the headache out of missile designing. Inasmuch as there has been no noticeable decline in the sale of aspirin to missile engineers, however, it is obvious that such announcements are somewhat over-optimistic. Sad to relate, most of the new and revolutionary materials turn out just so-so when tested. We could say the same today about battery technology. Which brings us to another problem area, the evaluation of calorimetric materials. There is a really critical need in the missiles field for a reliable short-time test to determine how various materials will perform in nozzles and similar components, and as nose cone insulators. Such a test should simulate the total environment in which the material is expected to perform, not just one or two environmental factors. For example, the results of subjecting a specimen to the blast of an oxyhydrogen blowtorch may tell us the material will resist high temperature and give us some idea of its heat transfer and thermal shock resistance. The blast from a properly adjusted blowtorch, however, is all gas. It contains no solid particles, such as those present in the exhausts of solid propellant rockets, has a low mass flow rate, and is nearly chemically inert. Hence, from a blowtorch test, we learn very little about the material's ability to resist oxidation, and the information we obtain on its erosion resistance is anything but conclusive. Matter of fact, many solid propellant compositions contain aluminium metal, and so you have molten aluminium oxide flowing through the nozzle. It's very erosive. Another procedure, a sort of super blowtorch test, is to place the specimen in the exhaust blast of a large rocket during a static firing test. In static firing, the rocket is restrained so it can't go anywhere. Instruments record thrust, chamber pressure, etc. This test is a little better than the blowtorch test, but is still unsatisfactory in several respects. The specimen is not subjected to high pressure, as it would be in the combustion chamber or nozzle, and the angle of impingement of the exhaust gases on the surface of the specimen is necessarily different from what it would be in the nozzle throat. Conducting a series of different tests to determine different properties of a material separately has not given satisfactory results, because the various environmental conditions are interrelated in their effects. Erosion is abetted by high temperature. Mechanical erosion and oxidation augment each other, etc. For nozzle materials, the most satisfactory results have so far been obtained by actually making nozzle throat inserts of specimen materials, installing them in specially designed static test motors, then examining the specimens after firing. Testing using materials for chamberliners is a bit risky, because if they prove unsatisfactory, it will probably be necessary to replace the motor. These test motors come in several different sizes, from the miniature micromotors to full size. The micromotors are used mainly for screening potential materials. The difficulty of scaling up the results obtained from them to apply to a large motor, however, limits their usefulness. Although the scale-up problem is considerably less formidable with larger test motors, there is still the frustrating fact that no two rocket designs ever produce exactly the same operating environment. A material may perform satisfactorily in one rocket, but fail in another rocket of similar design. From the above, it might appear that the only way to be certain whether refractory X will perform satisfactorily in a nozzle or what-have-you in missile Y is to make a what-have-you of refractory X and actually test it in missile Y. Such a procedure is, of course, too time-consuming and costly for developmental testing. Also, little can be learned from such one-shot tests. Actually, the picture is not so terribly dark, however. We have accumulated a considerable body of empirical data from evaluation tests of various kinds, as well as from a lot of experience with missiles of all shapes and sizes. In selecting a refractory for a particular missile component, the engineer must, on the basis of his analysis of the physical, chemical, and thermal environment, decide which material or combination of materials would most nearly satisfy the requirement. Almost always, the selection represents a compromise. Is the requirement for an exceedingly high melting point important enough to demand the use of a ceramic despite its brittleness and low tensile strength? Or can the lower melting point of a metal-bonded ceramic be tolerated for the sake of greater ductility and high strength? Is it more important for a particular component to be able to resist thermal shock? Or is a high degree of resistance to oxidation in a highly oxidizing exhaust stream material? Exhaust stream essential. Should a carbide or an oxide be specified? The engineer must, of course, design the component or its structural support in such a way that the desirable properties of the material are exploited while avoiding exposure to conditions that might cause it to fail. He would, for example, avoid subjecting a ceramic component to tensile stresses or a severe mechanical shock. One of the things that makes a rocket engineer's job a bit difficult at times is the lack of dependable data on the properties of materials at really high temperatures. As I mentioned earlier, the measurement of high temperature is very difficult. Well, so are properties such as tensile and compressive strengths, melting and boiling points, thermal conductivity, specific heat, etc., at temperatures such as we have been discussing. You can't very well take test equipment into a 5,000 or 6,000 degree furnace. Such data as are available were obtained by ingenious procedures, which we haven't the space to describe here. One problem is that refractory materials are not as yet standardized. Being new, the field is still in a state of flux. New materials are being developed all the time, and old materials already in production are being discarded. It is not unusual to find, after a missile development is well along, that the material around which some component was designed is no longer in production. There are a number of tricks or gimmicks that are employed to get the maximum use out of the materials we now have. Most of them aim at preventing the hot components from reaching temperatures that would seriously reduce their structural strength. There are two general ways of doing this. One, by reducing the rate of heat transfer to the components, and two, by increasing the rate at which heat is dissipated from the components. The reduction of the heat transfer rate is accomplished by interposing either a thermal insulating material or a comparatively cool film of gas or vapor between the component and the hot combustion gases. This latter scheme is called film cooling and works quite well, especially in nozzles. Introducing a liquid, usually water, into the nozzle at or near the upstream end during firing produces a thin layer or film of vapor on the interior surface of the nozzle. The vapor film flows through the nozzle, acting as a heat retarder, then on out the exit cone. Heat can be dissipated from a component by ablation, in which material is progressively sloughed off, carrying heat with it. Endothermic decomposition, wherein heat is absorbed by the chemical degradation of the material, and heat absorption by fusion or vaporization. I'll remark that film cooling, not with water, which would be much too oxidizing under the conditions, but kerosene, was, of course, used in the Saturn V engines, which is why you see the strange dark appearance of the plume in the ignition phase. Cooling by ablation or by endothermic decomposition can be applied to reentry nose cones, which can be made thick enough to allow for loss of material. The internal configuration of a nozzle, however, must remain substantially the same during firing. The throat especially must not enlarge appreciably, or the rocket will not perform properly. Although I will remark that ablative cooling in nozzles is actually used nowadays, even in hydrogen-oxygen rocket engines such as those in the Delta IV. Surprising, but true. Quite a difficult problem, also, it may be remarked, because the engine has to be test-fired for a considerable time. Nozzles can be cooled by the vaporization of liquid introduced into the interior of the nozzles through pores or channels created for the purpose. This was formerly called sweat cooling, but is now known as perspiration cooling, further evidence that our missiles are becoming more sophisticated. Porous ceramic materials impregnated with inorganic salts, which either melt and vaporize or sublime, absorbing heat in the process, have been used for lining combustion chambers. Perhaps the best-known method of cooling the nozzle is regenerative cooling. Unfortunately, it can be used only in liquid propellant rockets. Either the fuel or the oxidizer is first circulated through thin tubes or channels surrounding the nozzle, where it absorbs heat, then sent onto the combustion chamber. The RL-10 hydrogen-oxygen engine actually operates in what's called the expander cycle, where the hydrogen is used for regenerative cooling and then drives the turbo pump that pumps the propellants. Rather nifty. There are other types of gimmicks. For example, it has been found that design stresses considerably higher than those given by standard short-time creep tests may be used where a metal part must withstand a stress for a short period of time during which its temperature is rising at a high rate. The reason for this is that viscous flow begins when the temperature reaches the point, about 750 degrees Fahrenheit for steel, at which the rate of stress relief becomes greater than the rate of strain hardening. If the rate of temperature rises high, the time required for viscous flow to take place makes it possible to attain fairly high temperatures before serious plastic deformation occurs. It is obvious that all of the above gimmicks are merely temporary expedients. The cooling methods, with the exception of regenerative cooling, require the missile to carry excess weight in the form of material to expend in ablation or vaporization. Regenerative cooling requires pumps and associated plumbing, which of course add to the missile's weight. For the present, we are making do with the materials we have, as evidenced by our successes with ICBMs and satellite boosters. But those planet-hopping spaceships that you and I dream of, the ones that utilize the fantastically high-energy, super-exotic fuels, landing, blasting off, maneuvering in space, will have to await the development of much better calorobic materials. Much better. There are, of course, other possible kinds of reaction propulsion, ion, photon, etc., but they can deliver only very low thrust. They may be useful in interplanetary space, where the rocket is relatively free of local gravitational effects. To land on or blast off from a mass of planetary magnitude, however, chemical propulsion will be needed for a long time yet. But the future is not as black as it might seem. There are a number of promising approaches that are being worked on right now. There is, for example, the research in ultra-high pressures above 100,000 atmospheres. Even though the field is new, until a few years ago, nobody knew how to obtain such pressures. Some remarkable things have been accomplished. Artificial diamonds have been made by squeezing hot graphite. Boron nitride, a pretty good refractory except for its softness, has had its crystal structure changed by high pressure to increase its hardness until it is comparable to that of diamond. The new material is so different from ordinary boron nitride that it has been given a new name, Borazon. It is theoretically possible that fatigue strength, yield strength, creep resistance, and ductility of a great many materials can be improved considerably by subjecting them to ultra-high pressures, particularly at elevated temperatures. It has been found that a number of hitherto unknown solid phases can exist under high pressure. Only one phase of bismuth exists at normal pressure, but eight phases exist at 120,000 atmospheres, 1,800,000 psi, and 950 degrees Fahrenheit. It seems obvious that hitherto unachievable properties may well be obtainable through the use of ultra-high pressures. It also appears that some ordinarily non-miscible metals can be pressured into forming alloys. Another very useful tool for high-temperature research, the plasma jet, is a comparatively recent development. Theoretically, temperatures around 50,000 degrees Fahrenheit could be developed by the plasma jet. This has opened up a number of new possibilities in the spraying on of refractory coatings, the production of superpure metals and alloys, high-temperature testing, etc. Another new and exciting field that is just opening up is that of inorganic polymers. It may come as a shock to many old-timers that some inorganic compounds can be made to polymerize in much the same manner as organic compounds. Several inorganic resins with refractory metal atoms, hafnium and zirconium, in their molecular structures were synthesized recently. Preliminary tests of these resins foster the hope that we will, in the not-too-distant future, have a truly refractory plastic. Research in solid-state physics, crystallography, high-energy radiation, X-ray and gamma radiation, super high-intensity magnetic and electrostatic fields, ultrasonics, etc., may result in a breakthrough in the processing of materials at any moment. If propellant temperatures eventually get so high that no form of matter can withstand them, we will just have to confine and control the exhaust gases with some sort of non-material heat barrier. Remember back there we were talking about ionization of the combustion gases? When the temperatures increase, the percentage of ionization also goes up. So, when temperatures get high enough, we may be able to apply the principles of magnetohydrodynamics, in which our electrically charged ions will interact with a magnetic field. The hydrogen fusion people are already doing it. Too bad that chronoportation is not yet fully developed. If it were, we could go back and perhaps help the old professor figure out a gimmick for storing his universal solvent. But if we did, the world might now be without hardy purple petunias. The end. Yes, friends, I actually finished what I was reading this time before the end of the hour, although there is a little footnote from the editor this time. Since Mr. Porter's interests have been in the high-temperature field, he isn't aware that the old prof found the answer to storing his universal solvent in the cryogenics field. The solvol can be safely contained in a vessel made of its own solid state, which is held in a nitrogen-cooled copper mold. The only trouble was the prof then discovered that the universal solvent was, in fact, exactly what Porter's dealing with, heat. And that, of course, can't be frozen. So yes, that was the science article out of Analog Magazine, July 1961. A pretty interesting and valuable article, I think. Again, because it shows you what the people doing it, what the people doing it think of science technology. Actually, a quite interesting bit of reference library from P. Schuyler Miller, which I may read on another occasion, because he often has something interesting to say. So yes, tune in tomorrow, of course, at 19 UTC. For A Step Farther Out, in which I have various things to discuss, which I didn't discuss last week because I goofed, including this really nifty thing that I bought, and also quite possibly my latest film transfer, but also some, issues of social importance and that kind of thing, which you're accustomed to me doing by now. And I look forward to receiving your cards and letters. Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas, 76101, United States of America. And you can, of course, always send me some financial support. PayPal.me/PrometheusLives, Patreon.com/Publius_reads. And that always is encouraging for me.